This is FinTech Takes, the podcast keeping you in the loop on all the latest FinTech trends, news, and ideas. I'm Alex Johnson, creator of the FinTech Takes newsletter, your host and self-confessed FinTech nerd. Let's go! Hello, and welcome back to everyone's favorite monthly recap of everything that's been happening in the wide world of FinTech, FinTech Recap. My name is Alex Johnson, the creator of FinTech Takes, and I am joined, as always, by the man, the myth, the legend himself, Jason Mikula. Jason, how are you?
I'm doing pretty well. I am somehow, yes, still in Mexico City, at least when we're recording this. I think by the time it's out, you and I will both be in New York. So if you hear any erratic background noise, that's just what you get for being in a city of 20 million people.
At some point, we're going to have a longer conversation about Mexico City, a place I've actually never been. But yeah, just the like size and scale of it doesn't compute in my brain. So I'm going to need you at some point to break that down for us.
It is truly gigantic. I mean, for a quick anecdote, you know, the last podcast I recorded, I actually had to hide in the bathroom because there was like construction and very loud music that the construction workers were listening to.
Wow.
So this time I'm at least actually sitting, you know, in the apartment.
Well, it's funny you say that because like me and my small town Montana vibes, when I go to New York next week, like I'm going to be like, oh my God, you know, like I can't handle this. This is crazy. But for you, New York is like a vacation compared to Mexico City.
Indeed. Indeed.
Awesome. Well, yes, as you said, we will both be in New York. If folks are going to be at New York FinTech Week, if you're listening to this and New York FinTech Week is happening as this is in your ears, please try to track Jason and I down. Jason is really tall, so you'll be able to see him over the crowds, and we'd love to say hi in person. Jason, should we get into some news? Some stuff happened. Before we get started today, I wanted to tell you about another FinTech podcast that I'm a huge fan of. FinTech One-on-One, hosted by Peter Renton. If you don't know Peter, he's a true OG in the FinTech space. He created FinTech Nexus, formerly Lendit, one of the premier events and media companies in our space, and he's been a consistently great interviewer of executives and experts in FinTech and lending on his podcast since 2013. Let me say that again, 2013. Peter's been doing this for a long time. He's just as curious as I am about all things FinTech, but he's much smarter than me and has a delightful Australian accent. So be sure to check out the FinTech One-on-One podcast wherever you get your podcasts.
Yeah, some stuff, a lot of stuff happened. I mean, I guess we should start off with a dangerous journey to Bass Island.
We should. Do you want to make your joke about the Falklands War? Go ahead.
Yes, I do.
Okay.
I mean, this might be the greatest conflict over an island since the Falklands War, or if you're on the Argentine side, the Guerra de Malvina. If you don't know what I'm talking about, just go watch season 4 of The Crown. Now that I've used my terrible joke.
No, that was good. That was very good. I have to ask, did you know anything about this war before you watched season 4 of The Crown, or was that your education on the subject?
I did, because one of my good friends is Argentine, so I got that side of the conflict.
Okay, well, now that we have that out of the way, yes, walk us through the drama on Bass Island.
Okay, so probably the most significant piece of news was around a couple of consent orders that came out, one for Pyrmont and one for Sutton. Beginning with Sutton, it's widely sort of understood or believed that that consent order stemmed from its relationship with Cash App. Folks will probably recall the short seller report from Hindenburg about, I don't know, sometime last year, maybe like 9 months ago, highlighting, you know, some AML, KYC fraud risks. And that order was relatively narrowly construed on AML CFT and related third-party risk management. So in the continuum of orders, not the most severe one that we've seen for a Bass-related bank. For Pyrmont is interesting. It was formed relatively recently in 2019. And sort of one of its core pillars is, you know, banking as a service or fintech partnerships.
Right.
It worked with both Treasury Prime and Unit, and it also had, I'm going to laugh here because I don't know what word to use at this point, it also had direct relationships or relationships that existed outside of Treasury Prime. It did terminate or is working to end its relationship with Unit prior to this consent order becoming public. However, in a statement that they sent to me and I assume published publicly, are committed and continuing to work with Treasury Prime. Now, interesting pieces of this order, which was quite lengthy, but the pieces that stood out the most to me, in addition to, you know, the AML BSA stuff that we've seen in, I think, literally every BAS consent order, it also touched on EFTA, so the Electronic Funds Transfer Act, Reg E, including requiring a look back for prior customer complaints, as well as the Truth in Savings Act, or Reg DD, which governs disclosures and advertisements for deposit accounts. And as far as I'm aware, this is the first consent order that specifically touches on consumer compliance. Green Dot, it has an order that is forthcoming, presumably based on disclosures they made in an 8K that also touch on consumer compliance, but that order is not finalized yet.
Right, right.
So, I mean, that's sort of the biggest story. There were some other bits and pieces. CBW Bank, which actually doesn't get talked a lot about, is up for sale. So I reported that out a couple of weeks ago, and the bank confirmed that. One of the OG fintech partner banks worked with Simple, worked with Movin, was an early bank partner for Ripple. Synctera and Treasury Prime both had layoffs and emphasized that they're focusing on selling software to banks and or fintechs.
Yeah.
So, I mean, you actually recently published a piece looking sort of broad lens on the BaaS space. How do these sort of different data points inform how you're thinking about how things are evolving?
Yes. Anytime we say evolving,
I know.
Got to smile. I mean, the main takeaway I have, which I know you've touched on a lot as well, I think we're in a pretty similar headspace on this, is that this notion of direct is kind of sitting at the center of everything. And so many people have latched onto this word that it's kind of lost all meaning because people talk about direct as like just the bank going directly to a fintech company and no middleware platform has touched this deal in any way, shape, or form. They talk about it as direct in a sort of contracting and relationship standpoint, but the technology, there might be an interface layer in between, whether that's Treasury Prime or any number of other kind of technology platforms that sit in the middle, or it could be direct in, I guess, the most indirect sense, which is to say that the bank and the fintech company still have some direct relationship with each other contractually. Maybe they talk every once in a while, but a lot of the technology and even sort of operational day-to-day challenges are somewhat intermediated by a platform in the middle. So there's sort of this continuum of direct options, right? And when I look at someone like Piermont, which by the way, I didn't realize they started in 2019. That kind of blew my mind when you shared that in your newsletter. So they're just new to being a bank generally. I sort of look at what they've done in banking as a service as kind of representative of the industry overall, which is, hey, this looks like a cool business line. We should dabble in it. Okay, well, how do you want to dabble in it? Well, there's like all these different ways we could do it. We could go to Money 2020 and try to sell fintech companies. We'll go find fintech companies directly and introduce ourselves. We're a new bank. We were just formed in 2019. Let's go work together on some program. Don't worry about our core system. We'll integrate you into our core. It'll all be good. You know, and like, let's try to do a little bit of those direct, see how that goes. We're also getting calls from these different platform providers. So maybe we should work with this one that will help us do some selling and will definitely help with the technology perspective, but we'll have to do all the sort of operational bits ourselves. And then there's this other one that is promising kind of a similar model, but they have more of a role to play on some of the operational elements and managed services. And, you know, just to jump in like the, you know, immediate fintech time machine, a couple of years ago, I don't think there was really any regulatory clarity around which of these models might ultimately kind of win out or make the most sense. And so from a bank's perspective, given that everything was so new and regulators were sort of behind this trend generally, I think you could reasonably look at that and go, yeah, maybe we should kind of, I always think in terms of blackjack, I'm not sure why because I don't gamble. Maybe I spend too much time in Vegas. Maybe that's why. But like, here's the blackjack table. Let's play a bunch of different hands simultaneously at the blackjack table and sort of see which one works out the best. So they sort of split their chips across a number of different seats at the table. Now, as you indicated, there's an extreme amount of regulatory clarity, maybe too much to be totally candid. And it has pushed banks away from certain models. And so like that continuum of directness, I think it's pushed banks towards one end of that continuum, which is you should either be doing everything yourself or everything except technology yourself. And, you know, I don't know, these things tend to be kind of pendulums. And so we might see it swing far that way and then swing a little bit back the other way. I don't really know how that's going to play out. Obviously, we're headed into an election year and, you know, everything could be very different a year from now, knock on wood. So I think that that is going to ultimately kind of settle out maybe somewhere in the middle. But at the moment, I feel like we've really pushed towards one end of the continuum. Does that make sense?
No, it absolutely makes sense. I mean, there was a piece in This Week in FinTech Signals that, frankly, I disagreed at least with one of the arguments or the conclusions, which was that, you know, the regulators are not the ones sort of telegraphing something to the market. And I believe the piece specifically was talking about the consent orders. But I know that you follow like OCC and like Fed speeches and comments probably more closely than I do.
I like to parse them, yeah.
Yeah, it's fun.
Yeah, it is fun. Yeah.
For us anyway.
for a short number of people. Yeah, exactly.
And I do think it's difficult to dispute when you have phrases like, you know, complex technology-driven partnerships, which is sort of the description of those novel activities, supervisory programs at the Fed, and I believe also at the OCC, or, you know, the acting comptroller's use of the language, you know, supply chain and fintech partnerships. You know, can the regulators come out and say, this model is forbidden, you know, no bank can do it?
Right.
No, they cannot do that.
Yeah.
Can they make clear through their supervisory and enforcement processes and through these kinds of public statements that, like, you guys can do this, but you might regret it?
Yeah.
Well, you know, that seems to be the direction.
No, I mean, well, to put a fine point on that, I mean, I know you talk to a lot of folks on the regulatory side as well as at a lot of these banks, but like, just to give like a very specific example of what you're talking about, how your exam goes with your bank supervisor these days is very much a function of, do you do banking as a service? And if you do, how do you do it? And to your point, like, they're never going to say you can and can't do those things. That's not what they do. But they will change the nature of your exam in pretty meaningful ways, depending on what you do. And the message comes through pretty clearly, right? Like, option A, door A, you know, your exam is going to be relatively straightforward. We're not going to like bury you in paperwork or questions. We're not going to ask for documentation on every little single thing that you were doing. It'll be fairly clean cut and we'll get you out of that exam cycle and on your way. Good to go. Door B or door C, like, those exams are not going as well. They're much less pleasant. And whether they result in a public consent order or a private consent order or no consent order, the folks who are in the room in those exams are not having fun, right? And I think, like, when we talk about how regulators are expressing this opinion, it doesn't happen in obvious ways on the record. That doesn't mean they're not making it very clear to banks what they want to see. And so I think you're exactly right. The broader question I have for you, Jason, is, and I honestly think, like, sort of this is an existential question that regulators and others in the space are wrestling with, but, like, in what form should BaaS survive this current sort of drama that we're going through? Because, and this is, you referenced the piece I published today that'll have been out for about a week when folks hear this podcast. I sort of looked at this question through the language of competition and the lens of competition, because I do think for all of the problems in BaaS, and they have been myriad, obviously, I do think it is also inarguable that BaaS has facilitated a great deal of competition in the market, much of which has been positive and has had a positive impact on the market and outcomes for consumers and businesses, which regulators claim, even if they don't necessarily have a statutory mandate to focus on, they claim that's something that they want to see in the market. And so I do struggle with this idea that, you know, BaaS, at least in my mind, has some role to play in the future, maybe looking very different than how it's looked in the past. But what's your take on that sort of macro question?
Your analysis, I tend to agree with, unsurprisingly. I think usually we're like 99% aligned.
Yeah.
I mean, a piece of what you wrote that stuck out to me, which is maybe a little bit adjacent to the question you asked, was around the idea that, you know, regulators, policymakers talk about wanting to promote competition, but that frequently is sort of translated as we must protect community banks.
Yes.
Which, I mean, I understand why from like a political perspective, that tends to be how it shows up in policy. Although I would argue that sort of these are overlapping circles, like
right.
supporting competition and supporting community banks. Like there's an overlap there, but they're not like purely identical,
totally.
Right? And to your point about sort of where does this model go from here? I mean, something that is sort of an elephant in the room that frankly, I don't know if this is a question, you know, regulators are asking when they go into these exams is, as far as I'm aware, none of these sort of middleware platforms are profitable companies.
Right.
Which if a sort of key vendor to your bank, and that is legally what these platforms are.
Yeah. And increasingly describing themselves as like, we're a vendor to the bank. We're, you know, hopefully going to be supervised under the Bank Service Company Act soon. Like, I mean, they're really leaning into that angle. Yeah.
You know, that is a risk. You know, if the company that is supplying services to your bank, you know, particularly if those are, you know, key technology services, key, you know, compliance and regulatory services, is not profitable and is dependent on being able to raise external venture capital.
Yeah.
Particularly if they, you know, raised it a very inflated valuation in the, you know, 2020-2021 bubble.
Yeah.
Like that poses a problem. And so I do think there remains a question of, is this sort of middleware platform company sustainable on an economic basis as a standalone company? Or is this a piece of functionality that sits inside, God help us all, like a FIS, like an FIS Jack Henry, like a legacy core? Is it a piece of technology that is, you know, sold as, you know, SaaS or sold as a piece of software that is, you know, on top of or wrapped around that core? Or is it a, you know, is it a sort of standalone banking model a la what, you know, Column and Lead Bank and, you know, Grasshopper and you know, Peermont are doing.
Yep.
And I don't think the answer is abundantly clear. I will say, just given the facts that we have today, and admittedly, these are limited because middleware companies are, you know, private companies.
Yep.
They don't have to file financials. You know, anecdotally, I've tended to hear that revenue for these companies is sort of in a $10 to $20 million range.
Yeah.
Versus valuations, at least the last public ones, you know, in the billions.
Yes.
I am a bit skeptical that as a standalone business model is going to be something that's sustainable, particularly with the regulatory pressure that we've seen and the number of bodies, the cost that is likely to go along with that.
Yeah, no, I mean, you touched on a bunch of interesting stuff there. So just to kind of wrap up, I mean, first, when you... Fun fact, if you say FIS three times on a podcast, they appear like Beetlejuice and they try to buy whatever technology you're talking about. And so we won't say it any more than we've already said it. But I think that's a really good point about just sort of how this interfaces with legacy technology providers in the space. And to your point about just the business model part, a macro question I've been sort of noodling on is, what are the categories of fintech that would have been amazing to build as like a bootstrap businesses or as businesses within incubated within other existing companies, but that as standalone VC-backed companies, particularly raising money at the height of crazy valuations, there's almost no chance that they'll survive. And I think that's a really interesting question because sometimes when you hear like, oh, like this is a bad business model, you sort of conflate that to mean it's a bad company or a bad product, which I don't think is necessarily always true. Sometimes it is, but sometimes it's just, no, it's a good company, it's a good product, but based on their ownership structure and the incentives that sort of model places on them, there's almost no chance that they're going to be able to make it as a viable business. Whereas like, if you were to bootstrap one of these companies in 2020 and everyone looks at you like you lost your mind because no one is doing that at that time, you might actually be sitting pretty right now looking at a great exit or like having a very different sort of model. So I do think that is a really good observation that applies to BaaS and other areas, quite frankly. And then the last thing you mentioned that I just want to touch on real fast is the throwing bodies at things part is really interesting because I was digging in for this piece that I wrote. And one of the things I hadn't really realized, it's funny how like recent banking and fintech history, recent in quotes, meaning like maybe 10, 15 years ago, but like I was alive. I was even like in the industry at the time. I just wasn't paying attention to. When I hear consent order, I think it's community bank, I think banking as a service, But there are a lot of big banks that get consent orders. And in particular, like 10, 15 years ago, I didn't really realize this, but a lot of the big banks went through their own AML, BSA set of consent orders with regulators.
With really big fines, as I recall.
Huge. Yeah, U.S. Bank paid hundreds of millions of dollars in fines for a tragically bad BSA, AML controls that they had in place. And what was interesting, digging into those and sort of how those were remediated, was all the big banks just threw bodies at that, right? And if you're Chase or you're, U.S. Bank, you can do that, right? Like, I was reading about what Chase did sort of after 2010, 2012, when they got in trouble for this. They hired 3,000 people, including 500 people that were dedicated solely to AML and filing SARs and all of that work. And what was interesting about that was that, ironically, I think throwing people at compliance unintentionally kind of became a moat for big banks, in the sense that big banks can do it from a OPEX perspective, whereas small banks just can't. And so a thing I've been thinking about a lot, and I know you're familiar with a lot of the companies in this space too, RegTech focused on BaaS is a big business right now. And a lot of our companies that we, I think, know pretty well and have spent some time talking to, and actually you're going to be speaking with on stage next week at New York FinTech Week, they're focused on bringing technology and automation and efficiency and sort of streamlining a lot of these tasks. And I'll be very curious to see, in the short term and in the long term, what regulators' appetites are for a approach to compliance that doesn't involve just throwing more bodies at this. Because to me, that'll be a key question in banking as a service moving forward.
I'm 100% agree. Interested to see how regulators react to, especially if people start saying AI, AI approach or a sort of tech-focused approach versus the classic, throw bodies at the problem. But should we get on to our next story?
Let's do it. Yeah. So our next story is Chime. Jason, I know you saw this. I saw it. I don't think either of us wrote about it, so it made for a good topic for the podcast. Our friend, Ron Shevlin, who I will also say has been a professional mentor to me and was my former boss at Cornerstone. So we love Ron on this podcast.
And full disclosures.
Like, I am biased. I am completely biased. I just want to be very clear about that up front. Ron is awesome. Ron published an article in Forbes about Chime. This article was informed by, some of the news around Chime planning for an IPO at some point in the near to semi-near future, as well as data from surveys that he had done last year. And he does surveys on sort of bank account ownership and sort of primary banking relationships a lot. It's a topic that he comes back to frequently. He has kind of an established methodology for measuring consumer adoption and usage and attitudes around bank accounts. So in this article, he wrote that according to a July 2023 survey of U.S. consumers, Cornerstone Advisors estimates that Chime has more than 38 million customers, more than the number of checking account and or payment customers of SoFi, Dave, MoneyLion, and Current combined, more than three times greater than Cornerstone's estimates in 2021. So that means that, according to Cornerstone, Chime's customer base more than tripled between 2021 and 2023, and that their total number of customers is more than the combined number of banking and payments customers of SoFi, Dave, MoneyLion, and Current. That's a lot. Now, he elaborates, going on to say that of Chime's 38 million customers, about half consider the neobank to be their primary checking account provider. That works out to 8.1% of all American adults, 12% of Gen Zers, 9.5% of millennials, 7.5% of Gen Xers, and 2.9% of baby boomers. In contrast, Wells Fargo has 8.5% of the market, meaning primary checking account providers. So American adults who consider Wells Fargo their primary checking account provider, that's 8.5% for Wells Fargo and 7.6% for JP Morgan Chase. Okay, so Jason, again, just to emphasize, Ron is as sharp as they come on this type of stuff. I know for a fact, having worked with him, that he's extremely diligent about survey design, about the weights related to surveys, about extrapolating some of these sort of broad population level estimates based on survey results. He has a very good nose for all of this stuff, and I take him seriously when he does it. Having said all of that, I was shocked by these numbers. I mean, they honestly like didn't feel real to me given how big they were. And before we get into more detailed questions, I would just like for you to give me your like surface level reaction. What did you think when you saw this?
To be honest, it just didn't sound plausible.
Right.
It's like, in two contexts, right? One, the idea that, you know, 38 million is functionally like 15% of the US adult population.
Yes.
And that, you know, again, not based in any sort of real math or analysis, it's just like, it sounds crazy.
Yeah, 15% of American adults are Chime customers is what that number would suggest, yeah. Which seems crazy big to me.
Yeah. So, you know, Ron, like Cornerstone does this as a business. It's not like, yes, this is a one-off survey that he's running.
Yeah.
This is not like a one-off survey. You know, Ron and Cornerstone do this as a business. So to your point, you know, I have a high degree of confidence that they're using, you know, proper survey design, asking the right questions in a way that's not, you know, biased or confusing, proper sampling methodology and all that. And actually, I should disclose that I studied social science research methodology in graduate school. So I actually, at least at one point, kind of understood how those things worked. But yeah, the end result, just in the context of the gut check against, you know, whether it's Chase and Wells Fargo or something like Cash App, which I think reports about 56 million active users, you know, something like Cash App understandably has a much broader appeal because of its peer-to-peer payment functionality.
Yeah.
So just trying to triangulate like 38 million Chime users in the context of the adult US population, of other, you know, major incumbent banks, of, you know, Cash App, it made my head hurt.
Yeah. No, I think that's completely and totally fair. I mean, like, yeah, like Cash App is a good parallel, or like a PayPal or someone would be as well, where it's like, if you have P2P payments functionality, which is sort of like bank account like or bank account light functionality, that makes sense to have a broader universe, because you could totally see a scenario, and in fact I think a lot of consumers are like this, where you have your checking account with a sort of traditional bank or whatever, but you also have Cash App, and maybe you also have Venmo because you're sending money to different places. So like there's a lot of overlap, and you could see P2P payments being a much bigger number. But yeah, to your point, I mean, I think they offer some limited P2P functionality within the Chime customer universe, but like it's not like a broad...
I'm not rolling my eyes over here. Sorry, Chime. I like the product, but I mean, at this point, it feels like P2P is pretty much locked up by Venmo, Cash App, and Zelle.
Well, I mean, if you're rolling your eyes there, like Varo has three different P2P payment options they'd like to present to you. So the neobank strategy around P2P is a little strange, but like you could see those numbers being surprisingly big. And they are for Cash App and for Venmo and for some of those other providers, Zelle. But yeah, when it comes to Chime, where the core product is a checking account, that's the whole point. And that's what Ron's measuring in this survey. 15% is just massive. That's a huge, huge number. And then, of course, there's the considers them to be their primary checking account, which, again, that is, just to be clear, that's Ron asking who those folks consider to be their primary checking account. So that doesn't mean that they don't also have a checking account at Chase or Wells Fargo or a community bank or credit union. They probably do in a lot of cases, but when they're asked who their primary...
Or use Cash App and keep money in there, or
right.
Cash App and Venmo at a bunch of other places.
Right. So they might have a very like fractured picture in terms of all the accounts they have and where the money sits, but like just behaviorally, from a preference perspective, when you ask, who do you consider to be your primary checking account provider? Chime came back really strong, surprisingly strong, sort of unbelievably strong. What was your reaction to that part?
Okay, so I have two additional points. First, reacting to that, I mean, the question that I want to know the answer to is who's achieving the monetization or who's achieving the revenue, right? So I think, I don't know if Ron coined the term paycheck motel.
He did.
It's like, well, okay. Yeah. Credit to Ron.
Yep.
It's like, well, you know, does primary mean your paycheck is being direct deposited into Chime, but then you're moving it other places such that, you know, Chime is not necessarily generating the significant share of revenue? And that's, I think, you know, very difficult, if not impossible, to answer you know, conclusively in a survey versus, you know, other kinds of data sets.
Yeah.
So really it's like the question of primary and particularly asking somebody that in a survey versus looking at something like, you know, direct deposit adoption is a common one. One that I think our friend John Pitts was pitching was, is that the account they use to link to other services?
Right.
So when somebody is, you know, signing up for Robinhood or Cash App, are they using, you know, Plaid or MX or Finicity to link it to their Chime account or some other account?
And I have heard, by the way, that Chime and some of the other big neobanks are surprisingly high up on the list for that measure, which I think is interesting. And it obviously speaks to a fintech-savvy younger audience, which these neobanks tend to dominate with. But I actually have heard they do better on that one. But like the primary account for direct deposit, I wouldn't think would be quite as high. And then like another one is like where you link all your bills and pay your bills out of. So anyway, keep going.
Sorry, my second point, I'm going to use this as an opportunity to get on my soapbox about pull report data, because Chime notably is not a bank, you will remember, and partners with both Bancorp and Stride. Now, banks in their pull reports need to disclose the number of deposit accounts. But if it's one big FBO pot of money, I'm assuming that that shows up as like one account.
One big account.
One giant blob of money. Realistically, probably a couple blobs. But, you know, whereas Chime has somewhere between 1 and 38 million customers, right?
Right.
So, it you know, depending on what the argument is for what call reports are supposed to be used for, you know, we have a sort of inconsistent view of the number of accounts that are really on Bancorp and or Stride because of how this is structured.
Yeah.
And I think you and I'll call to arms Kia.
I was going to say, Kia had her ears perked right up for this conversation.
Yeah, it's like, would really like to see additional data points or just better defined and more consistently reported data points in these filings. Because, you know, given how bank fintech partnerships have evolved, just from like a structural standpoint, around the use of FBO accounts, omnibus accounts, and what have you, make it pretty difficult to try to discern what's happening at the underlying regulated banks.
Yeah, no, it really does. I mean, it's wild to think that there are 38 million customers hiding at a couple small community banks, right? Like, there's something about that sort of like the mechanics of that kind of break my brain a bit. And it does speak to this idea that neobanking or just B2C fintech generally at the highest level, that's a lot of scale running through these omnibus accounts and FBO accounts and these small community banks. So no, I couldn't agree more with that. To put a fine point on the primary checking account provider thing, I mean, just to reiterate, according to Ron's research, 8.1% of all U.S. adults consider Chime to be their primary checking account provider compared to 7.6% for Chase. And again, Chase is based on just overall amount of deposits, the number one bank in the country by far in terms of the overall volume of deposits. Now, obviously, a lot of those accounts are business accounts, commercial accounts, very sort of wealthy individual accounts. So there's obviously going to be some discrepancy there. But still, like, to get even more specific, more Gen Xers, according to Ron's research, as a percentage, consider Chime to be their primary checking account provider than the percentage of adult Americans overall who consider Chase to be their primary checking account provider. Like, that's wild to me. I mean, like, Gen Xers are not young. They're not. And like, they should be banking with Chase, you know? And like, I mean, like, Chase should, I would think, have a greater percentage of people who are the primary checking account provider overall than the number of Gen Xers that bank with Chime and consider them to be a primary checking account provider. Like, I would have bet all the money in my checking account, my own checking account, to that effect. And yet again, according to Ron's research, that's not correct. So to add one thought to this that I'm kind of curious about, like, let's just say we took Ron's research kind of at face value here. And again, there's ample reason to do that based on his expertise in this space. I don't understand what that means. You know what I mean? Because again, like, Chase and a lot of the other big banks have more of what you'd consider, I guess, to be prime checking account customers, like older customers, high net worth customers, obviously a lot of the corporate and business accounts. So a majority of the deposits sit with those banks. Does that mean that there are 38 million consumers that those banks just weren't paying any attention to whatsoever? Does that mean that, you know, Chime has stolen those accounts from community banks and credit unions? Like, who's losing share of all of these accounts relative to these other banks? Or does it mean that Chime has scooped up a great deal of folks who didn't have any bank accounts before? And to a certain extent, like younger consumers that are opening their first bank accounts, I'm guessing Chime grabs some of those. But the overall number of unbanked, truly unbanked individuals and households in the US, it's a tiny percentage. Like, it's, we talk about unbanked and underbanked all the time. It's actually not that many people. And so there, you can't get that many of the 38 million from that place. So I just don't, I either my understanding of the market and its overall size and composition is just wrong, and Chime has been addressing a much bigger market than I don't appreciate, or Chime has been taking accounts from providers at a rate that is truly impressive, or the numbers are maybe wrong or being misinterpreted. And when it comes to taking share away from other banks, the other thing I guess I'm curious about, Jason, is I know Chime spends a lot of money on marketing, but a lot of people spend a lot of money on marketing. And quite frankly, when I think about...
Chase spends a lot of money on marketing.
Exactly. Like, Chase spends a lot of money on marketing, both marketing as well as just putting branches up everywhere. Like, that's a different kind of marketing. You know, SoFi sponsors a stadium in Los Angeles, and they, you know, these companies run Super Bowl commercials. I mean, like, I don't consider Chime to be one of those companies where it's like, oh my God, like, I can't throw a rock without hitting a Chime advertisement. Like, I don't think of them that way. So while they do spend money on marketing, how are they acquiring these customers in a relatively comparatively not like going crazy marketing spend way when competition for all accounts in financial services is just really fierce? Like, what's their secret? It's breaking my brain the more I think about it, honestly.
Yeah, I mean, I think you ask an excellent question of, are they, you know, taking share from incumbents, or are these sort of like new accounts or new consumers coming into the market?
Yeah.
You know, I suppose if you look at the share by generation, it would seem to be somewhat supportive of the latter argument, given that it's like a bit over 12% of Gen Z, a bit less than 10 for millennial and so forth. You know what I mean? Another sort of ancillary point that has been top of mind, because I'm thinking of topics for New York FinTech Week.
Yeah, yeah.
In one of the pieces that folks in fintech often tout as a positive is the, you know, frictionless or reduction of friction, aka making it very easy to open new accounts, which, setting aside any of the KYC, et cetera, issues,
yeah,
you know, and putting on my sort of marketing or like business analyst hat, like, making it really easy to open an account, you know, is a good thing if you're calculating your cost of customer acquisition.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if you're looking at, you know, how many of those accounts are active, what is the average revenue per account and so forth,
yeah,
you know, it may boost the number of accounts, but then what share of those are active? I mean, I guess Ron has the considered primary here, but it just, it makes me wonder to what extent, you know, companies like Chime, but also others in the space, what the strategy is to monetize that customer and retain them.
Yeah.
I mean, again, Chime is not public. They disclose basically nothing.
Yeah, they're very quiet,
which I find very annoying.
Yeah, yeah, I know. Give us something here. Yeah.
Yeah, give us something. But if you look at some of the somewhat comparable companies in the space, like a MoneyLion, setting aside its weird affiliate business,
yeah,
or Dave, you know, the percent that are actually using those services actively tends to be like 25% or less. So actually sort of analyzing the business model, like, well, what are you spending to acquire? How long does that user, do they ever become active? If so, how long do they use your service? And then what is the actual revenue you generate? And again, the numbers from Vero based on the call report are frankly terrible. The numbers from Dave and MoneyLion, like, are somewhat better actually, because they tend to do more like lending or things that look like lending. So yeah, I booked Chime IPOs so we can see the S1.
Yes, yes. No, I mean, that's a good place to leave it, because I feel exactly the same way. I mean, all of this is bubbling towards an IPO, and I just don't, like, if I was an investor looking at Chime and thinking about buying stock, I would look at this 38 million number and I would try to understand what it means, you know? And like, to your point, I mean, there's a plausible scenario here where, you know, some Gen X consumer who wants to stick it to the man has a Chime account opened along with their Chase account, and their direct deposit goes to Chase, their bills are paid out of Chase, the debit card that they use is Chase, but they have a Chime account, and when they get asked in a survey which they consider to be their primary checking account, they're like, you know what, fuck Chase, Chime is my primary checking account. Like, maybe there's a certain amount of like sticking it to other providers in answering that question there, but when it comes down to the raw calculation on where are people going to make money, who can you lend money to, who can you cross-sell to, you know, which ones are driving interchange rates, which deposits are really sticky, all of those are going to drive the business reality for Chime. And this is going to be like the S1 I'm going to care more about than any other one when these companies start going public. Because to your point, we have no visibility into it apart from this 38 million number. And I just don't know, like, are they sitting on a gold mine or are they not? And I don't know the answer to that.
We will have to reconvene when they release their S1.
Okay. Well, we'll definitely, maybe we'll record a special podcast. Jason, a couple quick ones for you before I let you go. You wrote a thing in your newsletter that I think got sort of swamped by all the Bass news, but I actually found it to be more interesting in some ways. Maybe I'm just sort of oversaturated on Bass, but I talked to us about trade groups versus Colorado, because that story actually fascinated me.
So this is one of my like hobby horse issues I've been following, which is sort of like the ongoing battles between certain states or other jurisdictions that want to, they would argue, protect their residents, their consumers,
yeah,
from out-of-state banks that are charging interest rates in excess of the state usury cap. So this has showed up in a couple of places in different formats. Most notably, California has had a long-running suit with a subprime lender, OppFi. DC engaged in a similar suit, and OppFi chose to leave that jurisdiction, given it's relatively small.
Yep.
And more recently, we've had Colorado pass a measure to, bear with me, opt out of the DIDMCA, which, ooh, I honestly can't off the top of my head remember what that stands for. But
that's a hell of an acronym, yeah.
It is. And passed in 1980, it has a lot of different components, but one of them was sort of codifying state chartered banks' ability to export the interest rate of their home state. However, each individual state or jurisdiction could choose to opt out of that provision in regards to loans made in, I'm making air quotes there, made in their state. So over the course of, geez, like the past 44 years, a handful of states have like opted out and then opted back in. And until recently, it was only Iowa and Puerto Rico that had opted out of this provision. More recently, we've seen a couple of states either opt out or sort of consider doing so, including Colorado. Now, the internet didn't really exist in 1980,
right?
So that this legislation, you know, did not necessarily contemplate what the implications of that would be. And Colorado was basically seeking to block out-of-state licensed banks and their fintech partners from lending into Colorado. A handful of trade groups filed a suit basically arguing that the definition of made in, and I'm going to quote from the suit, under federal law, a loan is only made in a state other than the state where the bank is chartered when all of the key functions associated with the originating loan, including the bank's decision to lend, communication of loan approval decision, and dispersal of loan proceeds, occur in that other state. So basically, the case is saying, you know, if you have a Utah chartered bank and a consumer in Colorado, as long as some of these things are happening in Utah, Colorado can't block it. I would also point out that it is unambiguous that a nationally chartered bank that offered identical products, so credit at rates above Colorado's usury cap, would not have an issue because DIDMCA only applies to state chartered banks. So there's all sorts of like weird, thorny, you know, dual state federal banking system kind of implications here. But yeah, definitely one to watch. I mean, we've seen an increasing number of progressives, I don't want to go there, but states sort of try to block high APR products with, I would argue, sometimes like dubious legal arguments. That seems likely to continue.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. I mean, this idea that you can evade sort of usury caps and other restrictions on loans is really interesting. And, you know, I mean, it's just, you're right. I mean, 1980, they weren't thinking about it in the context of the internet where, you know, the reality is for the consumer, I mean, I'm just sort of putting on my consumer hat. Like when I jump on Google and I look for a loan, in no way does it enter into my mind where physically, geographically, the provider that I pick is located. It doesn't matter, right? Because like the loan is electronic, the money is being transferred electronically. Like it has no bearing on my decision as a consumer. And, you know, I think this is kind of the policy question attached to this is if I'm like a resident of Colorado, let's just say, do I appreciate Colorado preventing me or trying to prevent me from getting access to loans above a certain APR threshold? Or is that actually not helpful to me because my alternatives for getting that liquidity are significantly worse than they would be if I was able to just get access to this online loan? And, you know, I'm not a resident of Colorado, so I guess I'm not qualified to weigh in on that particular one, but they are my neighbors to the south. And I do think that, like, that is fundamentally the thing at issue here is that the consumer, all of these like fights don't really take into consideration like what the consumer wants, what they expect, what's best for them. It's this weird sort of dual banking battle that plays itself out in the behind the scenes. So I'll be very fascinated to see how this plays itself out. But it does feel like since 1980 and really just in the last like 10 years, this has picked up a lot of steam.
Well, in this one last comment and, you know, we can move on. But
yeah,
this isn't even really a fundamentally new issue. I mean, Rent-A-Bank was a hot topic in the early 2000s, specifically related to payday loans.
That's right.
And as I recall, the way that that sort of wound down was regulators, and I think it's both FDIC and OCC, basically leaning on banks and saying, we consider this an unsafe and unsound practice, like knock it off.
Stop doing that. No, it'll be interesting. A thing I've become much more aware of recently is the secret fights that happen between state regulators and federal regulators, which is an area I'm going to be paying more attention to moving forward. Jason, I am not going to make you expound too greatly on this, but can you give me one quick take on the Visa MasterCard settlement with merchants?
Okay, two very quick takes, I promise. Yeah. One, can we stop using the word swipe fee? It's imprecise and it annoys me. It's like, say what you mean, which is like either interchange or the entire merchant discount rate. I understand that like mainstream business press is like not going to parse that, but okay, pet peeve, one.
With you.
This settlement is bad for consumers, right? There's unlikely to be any savings passed along to them, and it's going to result in a worse/more confusing/possibly more expensive experience at checkout. Like, am I going to be at Peter Luger and deciding, should I use my Peter Luger charge card, my Visa Infinite, you know, Chase Sapphire Reserve or my Amex, and like look at like a pricing matrix and decide like what the right choice is? So yeah, my hot take is, it might be good for the largest merchants that are on Interchange Plus pricing, and it's probably bad for everybody else.
I think that is exactly right. As with anything that touches this topic, it's really just a question of, is money in the pocket of issuers or the large merchants? And everything else is sort of ancillary to that question, which is weird because to your point about being frustrated about the mainstream business press, please, please, please never, ever even entertain the notion that this money is going to get passed on to consumers. Just don't.
Not going to happen.
Do not do that. That is not... There's no basis in reality for that to ever even be a thing. So please stop it. But I think the other point I would just add to what you said is it will be really confusing to consumers because the bigger deal, apart from the reduction in interchange rates, which isn't going to matter apart from a few big merchants, is I'll be curious to see if anyone really takes advantage of this ability to surcharge or discount transactions based on the card that you're using. And the rules for each of those are a little bit different. But I could absolutely see a scenario where, like in an e-commerce environment, I am presented with different pricing somewhat dynamically as I'm shopping around based on discounts that they're going to give me if I use certain cards. Maybe based on an understanding of what cards I've used if I've shopped with them in the past, but like I might get messages in e-commerce shopping environments where they go, hey, we know you like Capital One, but we don't like Capital One. We are willing to give you a discount of X if you use a different card than Capital One on this product. And oh, by the way, unlike surcharging where you're charging more, discounts, actually, there's no cap on them. So we can discount as much as we want to like stop you using Capital One. And so like that's going to be weird and friction filled. It's going to make e-commerce in particular, I think, not so much in person because some of the restrictions there are a little harder, but for e-commerce, it's going to get wild, I think. So I'm fascinated to see how that's going to work. I also think it's amusing that our friend Kia, who's a super optimizer of credit card rewards, her life might be made more difficult by this and having to juggle when to use which card. So it'll be weird and confusing for everyone.
And always unintended consequences. But should we do what we can't let go of and call it a day?
Let's do it. Why don't you go first?
Okay. So this is a short rant, but like, how are people still misusing the FDIC logo unless it, I mean, if it's intentional, which we saw in like the crypto world,
yeah,
like that's one thing.
Yeah.
But unintentionally misusing the logo, which there is one company I'm specifically thinking of where it took up basically the entire screen. And as of the time of this conversation, that is still on their website.
I was like,
it just boggles my mind. Like marketing review doesn't particularly lend itself to automation.
No.
I mean, that there are companies that do some stuff in that space, but it typically is like, I'm either sitting with or sending a PDF to, you know, my lawyer, my compliance team. But like, is anybody looking at this stuff? So yes, we are in our year of the Lord, 2024, still just like massive, easily avoidable self-inflicted wound where, you know, if you don't fix it yourself, you will probably eventually get a cease and desist letter from the FDIC.
Yeah, well,
I will publicly shame you.
Yeah, or Jason will find you. Yeah, no, I couldn't agree more. I mean, some of this stuff is hard, right? Like some of the stuff we've talked about with banking as a service and with some of these compliance things, like some of it is hard. Like, you know, Reg E dispute processes are sort of challenging. You know, even like BSA, AML stuff and when to file a SAR, like not all of this is easy operationally. Marketing is so easy. Like the FDIC tells you exactly what you're supposed to do. They've updated their guidance. Like it's so easy. So I could not be more with you on that. Like, please don't screw that up anymore. My rant is not really related to that, although I think you'll have some empathy for this, Jason. Mine is about anonymous fintech troll accounts on Twitter. So we, I think, both know and interact with lots of anonymous accounts on Twitter. I actually find most of those accounts to be delightful, right? Because a lot of them are like, hey, you know, I used to work at this place or I work in this type of job. I can't really tweet under my own name, but I want to engage substantively and positively and constructively on Twitter and share my expertise. Fantastic. I love that. However, specifically within a fintech context, there are a set of people, and it's a relatively small number, thank goodness, who I'm pretty sure are on Twitter under their real names, but have also created like these alt troll accounts to basically just be mean about fintech stuff to fintech people on Twitter. And I really, really, really don't like that because there's zero value to engaging with them because like they're anonymous. So like literally like there's no value to engaging with them at all. And they're just lobbing bombs at you. And so like for me, if you want to stay anonymous on Twitter, be nice. That's my request. Just be nice, be positive, engage substantively. If you want to lob bombs at people on Twitter and pick stupid fights, use your real name. That's my rant.
That seems fair. Yeah, I will say I find that there are, to your point, a lot of anonymous accounts that add value and you can understand,
totally.
You know, especially if they're lawyers or
yeah.
regulators, and lawyers tend to be risk averse.
Totally.
Why they would either, you know, need or want to be anonymous. But
yes.
If you want to be mean to people, you know, do it to their face in your own name.
That's right. At least, I mean, like, we're not encouraging people to be mean. Don't be mean.
Please don't.
Be nice. But if you have to, if you can't help yourself, do it under your real name. So with that request, Jason, I am so excited to see you next week in person in New York. We actually are going to be speaking on stage together, which should be super fun. And for anyone who's there at the event, as you're listening to this, please come track us down. And Jason, we'll do this again in about a month.
Can't wait. Till then.
Thank you for listening to this episode of FinTech Takes. Stay up to date with emerging companies and the latest FinTech trends by subscribing wherever you get your podcasts. And if you love FinTech Takes, please tell a friend.